Hallo und willkommen bei Was Bitcoin bringt, dem Bitcoin-Podcast aus Wien, präsentiert von Coinfinity. Heute machen wir wieder mal ein englisches Interview mit Vijay Boyapati, dem Autor von The Bullish Case for Bitcoin, auf Deutsch, Im Auge des Bullen, das Argument für Bitcoin. Am 28.03. erschienen jetzt als deutsches Buch bei Apricot Media mit einem Vorwort von Michael Saylor. Wirklich ein spannendes Buch und ein spannendes Interview, wo wir uns wieder mal mit den Grundlagen von Bitcoin beschäftigen, aber natürlich auch den aktuellen Entwicklungen, dem Bankenchaos und auch den regulatorischen Dingen aus den USA. Viel Spaß bei diesem tollen Interview mit Vijay Boyapati. Und holt euch auf jeden Fall das Buch bei apricot.media, kann man natürlich auch mit Lightning bezahlen. Dass Apricot Media der beste deutsche Bitcoin-Verlag mit den auch am schönsten designten Büchern ist, das ist bekannt. Und bei Apricot Media gibt es jetzt eine neue Serie rund um Austrian Economics. Gestartet wird mit Karl Menger und einiges kommt da noch auf euch zu. Die Bücher kann man bei apricot.media alle mit Lightning kaufen und dort gibt es natürlich auch solche Klassiker wie den Bitcoin Standard, den Fiat Standard, Layered Money oder mein persönlicher Favorite, der Preis der Zukunft von Jeff Booth. Unbedingt mal reinschauen. Dass die Inflation auf uns zukommt, davor haben uns Marc Walleck und Ronald Stöferle, die beiden Fondsmanager und Partner von Incrementum, schon lange gewarnt. Und jetzt ist sie da, jetzt ist sie ein richtiges Problem. Incrementum hat mehrere Fonds aufgelegt, die da helfen können, da eine Lösung sein können, teilweise auch wirklich auf Inflationsbekämpfung ausgelegt sind. Was Incrementum auch macht, ist Gold und Bitcoin zu kombinieren in eigenen Fonds, um da neue Wege zu gehen. Es gibt Bitcoin-Chartbooks, Bitcoin-Analyse und den jährlichen Gold-Report, wo ich auch ordentlich mitschreibe. Einfach mal reinschauen bei incrementum.li. Es geht wieder los 2023. Das wird das bisher beste Jahr, was Bitcoin-Konferenzen im deutschsprachigen Raum betrifft. Da bin ich mir ganz sicher. Am 27. April geht's los in der Schweiz am Bodensee, Kreuzlingen am Bodensee, die Swiss Bitcoin-Konferenz. Ein neuer Auftritt sozusagen. Ich bin dort dabei, gemeinsam mit einigen coolen Speakern, die ihr schon aus dem Podcast kennt. swiss-bitcoin-konferenz.com. Dort findet ihr alle Details. Und mit Was Bitcoin bringt, als Code in einem Wort zusammengeschrieben, gibt es 5% auf alle Karten. Aber damit nicht genug. Die BTC 23, die größte deutschsprachige Bitcoin-Konferenz, wo die gesamte Community zusammenkommt in Innsbruck im September, die geht wieder über die Bühne. Mit Was Bitcoin bringt, gibt es auch dort 5%. Ich bin dort Speaker, ich bin dort Moderator. Ich freue mich sehr auf euch. Die letzte war wirklich super. September 14 bis 17, 2023, die BTC 23 auf bconf mit C, bconf.de gibt es die Karten und mit Was Bitcoin bringt, gibt es auch dort 5%. I'd like to welcome Vijay Boyapati, the author of The Bullish Case for Bitcoin. Hi Vijay.
Hi Nico, thanks for having me on your show.
How are you doing? Is this the first time you're on the German show?
It is. I'm excited to speak to a German audience for sure.
Your book is going to be published at the end of March. It's going to be published by Apricot Media, our good friends and partners who have also published The Bitcoin Standard and The Price of Tomorrow and Layered Money and other really good books about Bitcoin. But yours is, I think, a special one. You told me that you keep it very, very simple. You keep it very general. And the main topic of the book is why Bitcoin, you know, has any value at all and where the value could go. And being a podcaster and a YouTuber, I know that people want to know, you know, where the price goes. So maybe we do like the most embarrassing question first. You know, where's the Bitcoin price going in your opinion?
Well, I think it's very clear that we've entered a bear market. And anyone who's been following Bitcoin for, you know, a long time has seen these cycles happen before. And I talk about this, the shape of these cycles in the book, how they're kind of like a fractal pattern. And what I mean by that is if you take the price graph of one of these cycles from, say, 2014 to 2017, it looks very similar to the price pattern now. It's just the price pattern now is larger, it's higher. The all-time high was higher than it was in 2017. I think we've entered a bear market, and what we know about bear markets from prior cycles is that they last a fairly long time. They can last two and a half years. And what happens is you establish a plateau, a price plateau. Basically the shape of the graph is a Gartner hype cycle, and what that means is you start out with a plateau where there isn't much interest except from people who really have high conviction in the technology. And I should say that Gartner hype cycles apply to other technologies too, not just to Bitcoin. But so you start out with people who really have a lot of high conviction, and not many other people are interested. But people like me go around talking to friends and family and say, this is really important. It's going to change the world. And then you get a few other people coming in slowly but steadily. And the plateau, the price starts increasing slowly but steadily. Then you get speculators who become interested in, and they look at the price of Bitcoin and they say, well, this has been around for a year or two and it hasn't died. I mean, that's what happens during the bear market is everyone says Bitcoin's going to die. It's never going to come back. But it doesn't die because you have this base of people who have very strong conviction. So then eventually the price starts creeping up slowly but surely. The speculators come in and then you get the parabolic part of the cycle where the price starts moving up in this parabolic curve. And then you get a crescendo. The price reaches a crescendo where people are just... they have no conviction at all. They barely know anything about Bitcoin, just throwing money at it because they can see that it's going up and they want to be part of it. And then eventually you exhaust the supply of people who are reachable in that cycle, the supply of investors who have capital that will invest in Bitcoin. And the people who invest in Bitcoin in each cycle grows. So in the first cycle, the people reachable, as I say in the book, were people like cypherpunks and libertarians and people who had heard about Bitcoin in the early days. And there's only, you know, a fairly small supply of those people. There's not like billions of cypherpunks on Earth. So the people who were speculating on Bitcoin in the early days is very small. So the price chart, once it had reached all those people, it gets to the top of the Gartner hype cycle, and then you get this crash where there aren't more people to continue to push the price higher and higher in this exponential way. And then you get a crash, and you get this sense of just extreme pessimism. Oh, this was all like a scam. It's not going to stick around. Bitcoin's dead. It's not coming back. And then you get to the point of extreme pessimism where you all the people who were speculators are purged out. They sell. They have no more. They feel despair. They don't want to be involved anymore. But then the price starts to flatten again and reach a new plateau that was higher than the previous plateau. And that is what I believe has happened. I think we've gotten through the liquidation phase, the extreme fear, the extreme pessimism of the bear market, which I think was, you know, the price was around 15,000. I think we're in this plateauing process. Now, where it ends up, whether it's at, you know, 20,000, 25, 30,000, somewhere around there, it's going to plateau. And then in a year or two, we're going to have the impetus for the next cycle, which is the halving, which is an intrinsic event in Bitcoin, which halves the amount of inflation. So Bitcoin has an inflation schedule where the number of Bitcoins produced per year is a certain amount, and that gets shrunk. And this is unlike any other monetary good. It's certainly unlike fiat currencies like dollars and the euro, for instance, which have no bound on the inflation. They can keep the supply of the euros and dollars grows forever. It'll never stop. Gold has some limit because it becomes harder to mine gold as you extract all the easy to obtain gold from the surface of the earth. It becomes more and more difficult, and you have to use heavy machinery, and it becomes more costly. But gold also has an inflation schedule. The amount of gold that gets increased is about 2% of the total supply of gold. Bitcoin is the only monetary good where the inflation schedule keeps going down and will eventually get to zero. So every 4 years, we have this event called the halving, where the amount of inflation in Bitcoin gets halved. That's going to happen in 2024, and that will be the impetus for the next cycle, as it has been in the prior cycles. So I don't know, you know, when people ask me about the price, I can't give a specific price for what is the bottom, what is the top? But what I can say is that Bitcoin has had these cycles three or four times already, and I believe they will continue into the future. I think this is the process of monetization. And the cool thing is, as students of economics, we can observe this and say, wow, I would never have known this is what the process of monetization is. Because the process of monetization for gold, that took millennia. It's not like we could have observed it. We can observe this with Bitcoin, and we can sort of say, this is something new that we've never seen before. A monetary good going from no value to becoming the reserve currency of the world. It doesn't happen in a straight line. It happens in a series of cycles, and I believe they'll continue to happen. So where does Bitcoin get in the next cycle? I believe it'll go higher than it did in the prior cycle. I think the plateau that we've found is already significantly higher than the plateau of the prior cycle. The plateau of the prior cycle is probably around, $6,000. The plateau of this cycle is probably going to be about $20,000-$25,000.
You published the article that was then made into the book, The Bullish Case for Bitcoin. You published this in 2017, I think, when the Bitcoin price was about $1,000. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Afterwards, after you published it, and be honest here, did you, after maybe the crash of 2017, 2018, was there any moment in time when you thought, well, maybe, just maybe I was wrong, maybe it's not going to work out in the end?
No, I didn't in the 2018 cycle. Actually, I should correct you just slightly. I started writing the article when the price was 1,000, and it took me quite a long time to write the article. I had a job and I had my first child with my wife. And it took a year, and I published at the end of the cycle. I started writing at the beginning because I wanted to provide a resource to friends and family who didn't know why I was so excited about Bitcoin, and they would ask me these questions like, why did you invest in this thing? What is it about? And there was a lot of misconceptions back then in 2017 about Bitcoin, and I just wanted a resource for my friends and family. And I was really surprised that it was read as much as it was read over a million times, translated into 20 different languages, more than 20 languages. And by volunteers. I didn't do any of that. I don't speak 20 languages. That was the context of why I wrote it. But no, I didn't lose hope. I think if I lost hope at any stage, it was the prior cycle, which was the 2013 to 2015 cycle. That's when Mt. Gox collapsed. There's a very prominent Bitcoin developer, Mike Hearn, who wrote an article in the New York Times saying, Bitcoin is dead. It's not coming back. I don't want to be involved in this project. Here are all the problems. And that was a long, long bear market. It was from the end of 2013 really to, feeling hope again, late 2016. So it was a long 2 years, over two years. And I think a lot of us, believed in Bitcoin, believed in its transformative nature for the world and the ability to keep your savings and not have them debased and to take your savings wherever you want. That was, we believed that was really important. But it also felt like, who knows if this comes back? Who knows if this takes 10 years to come back, because we didn't have experience of many cycles prior to 2013. That was the real big one. There was one really small cycle before then, but the 2013 cycle was the first really big cycle. Now we've seen four of them and they all look very similar. So I was much less worried in 2018 and certainly not worried now. I think Bitcoin has established itself as a global monetary good that has value that a lot of people recognize, and that's not going to change. I don't think Bitcoin is going anywhere. I think it's kind of like the internet after about 10 years. In the first 10 years, people thought about the internet and they said, this is interesting, but what is it useful for? What are we going to do with this thing? I mean, there were people saying, why would I use email? Paul Krugman, famous economist, said the internet's going to be no more valuable than the fax machine. But if you go ahead 20 years to 2010, it was obvious to everyone that the internet was an incredibly important institution to the world. Bitcoin is sort of halfway there. It's at the 10-year mark. And I think once we get another 10 years into the future, people will have that same sense that this is a permanent institution in the world. It's not going away. And it's going to be like gold. It's going to be here forever. But it's superior to gold in a number of different ways that I talk about in my book.
The difference between Bitcoin and the internet is that, well, one thing for Bitcoin that speaks for Bitcoin is that we didn't have the internet to talk about the internet. Now we have the internet to talk about Bitcoin, so things could go quicker. But we also didn't have, there wasn't a central bank and the government who wanted to stop the internet. Or am I wrong with this? Because so my question is basically, you said before that Bitcoin is going to be the reserve currency of the world, which from an economics point of view is rather easy to understand. I would want you to make the argument, please, so we can for the listeners and the viewers. But there's also a lot of backlash, right? There's a lot of people who don't want this to happen. This didn't happen with the internet. So does this factor into your calculation?
I would push back a little bit on that, Nico. I think that's not quite true. I think the internet disrupted a lot of industries. For instance, the news industry. Newspapers were sort of the channel that, and news organizations, the television as well, were the channel through which information was disseminated out into the world. And they've been incredibly disrupted, and they've been very unhappy about the effect of the internet on their businesses. I mean, the New York Times was worth 10 times as much as it is today. It was a much, much bigger business. And the government as well in the United States pushed back on very important aspects of what is critical to the internet today, such as encryption, strong encryption. In the early 90s, they classified strong encryption as a military technology, as classified that couldn't be shared with anyone. And there's the famous incident of some cypherpunks taking the code to do encryption and printing it on a T-shirt. And saying this is protected in the United States by the First Amendment, which is the freedom of speech, which is ingrained into the United States Constitution. And there was a very strong battle about this in the 90s. So I would push back a little bit and say that the internet wasn't this thing that was kind of welcomed by everyone. There were certain strong interests who pushed back, and certainly the government was very cautious about giving people the ability to communicate without being monitored. Governments love to monitor their populations. So, but you are right. I will accept that the interests today are very, very powerful. Central banks are amongst the most powerful institutions on earth. And the banking system as well is certainly set to be disrupted by the rise of Bitcoin and the ability of people to self-bank. To hold their savings without a bank doing it for them. So there will be pushback, there will be a fight. But I still don't think nation states have fully appreciated the existential threat that Bitcoin poses to their monetary policy. And that threat is that global savings move into Bitcoin. And what does that mean if that happens? It means that central banks can't control interest rates anymore. They can only control interest rates by manipulating the supply of the currency, and they control their own currencies. If the supply of savings moves out of fiat currencies and into Bitcoin, they don't have the power to manipulate the supply of Bitcoin. The supply schedule of Bitcoin is known ahead of time because it's baked into the protocol. It's part of the programming of the Bitcoin network. We know exactly what it's going to be. We know what the inflation schedule is exactly, 120 years into the future. So that is actually a scary proposition for nation states. So they don't fully appreciate yet that their most, or probably their second most important sovereign power is monetary policy. The first most important is military power, projecting military power into the world and but after that is monetary policy, because that gives them the ability to extract savings from a population and use those savings for the purposes of the state, whatever those purposes are. And once you lose that, the state cannot maintain its size. The size of states today in the 21st century is much, much greater than it was, say, a century and a half ago, because the ability to inflate a nation's currency gives nation states the ability to extract much more savings from the population and fund operations of the state. So my view is, if Bitcoin becomes the reserve currency of the world, nation states will have to shrink in the size and scope of what they do. And that's an important issue for me, because I think warfare in the 20th century has been one of the most destructive forces in the long history of humanity. And it's because nation states became much more powerful and they were able to extract so much more savings. So warfare and inflation always go together hand in hand. From the beginning of the creation of central banks, that was the big issue. How do we fund a war? That's how the Bank of England was created. How do we fund this war with the French? So for me as a libertarian, having a new reserve currency which is not inflatable will produce a lot of benefits to the world.
It seems to me that the situation right now regarding Bitcoin in the US is rather, let's say, okay. I mean, maybe you could correct me on this, but it's weird because compared to Europe, right? In Europe, we're going to have a whole framework. It's called markets and crypto regulation. It's a whole giant bureaucratic thing for all of crypto, with two problems. First of all, Bitcoin and the rest of crypto are lumped in together. And second, there is still like a small possibility to use this to introduce a proof of work mining ban in Europe, which is of course insane. And we've talked about this on the show a lot, but it's interesting for one reason, because other than the US, Europe actually, and the European countries who are in the Eurozone have actually given up their power to print money as a nation state. That's the whole, that was one of the ideas of the euro. That's also why the euro has many problems, but it was one of the ideas. On the other hand, it seems to me that the US is actually more open to adopting Bitcoin, while Europe is super scared. Actually, not so much of Bitcoin itself. They're more scared about the dollar coming, you know, on crypto rails, basically, and taking over, because in the end, and this is where I want to go with this, we don't really need more than one money in the world, do we?
I don't think we need more than money. One money. I actually agree with that. I think that it's just that Bitcoin is superior money. I think the digitization of the dollar doesn't, to me, that's not an interesting proposition. It's just making a flawed currency available to more people. I would rather an ideal currency available to more people, which is why I think Bitcoin, I prefer Bitcoin. And I think there are reasons why you should prefer Bitcoin, because your savings can't be debased. That is, a fundamental need of humans is to accumulate savings over time through hard work and know that those savings are safe. It's a universal need that's existed in all times and all places. So I think on that aspect, Bitcoin is superior to anything that's ever existed before, certainly superior to dollars and the euro and the yen, but also superior to gold as well. You know, this venerable non-sovereign monetary good, which has existed for thousands of years. Some people, certainly gold bugs, will say, well, why do you need Bitcoin? You have gold. Well, Bitcoin is superior to gold because it has all the benefits of gold, but it's like gold with teleportation built in. And this is a incredibly powerful thing, to be able to transport value across the world as easily as you can send an email. This has never been possible before in the history of the world. So this is a historic, world-changing innovation. In history, you always needed an intermediary. You always needed someone sitting between you and the recipient at a far distance. If you were in Rome and you wanted to send value to someone in China, you needed intermediaries along the way who you trusted to get the value across. And in our modern world, that's banks and nation states. But now we can transmit value between each other without anyone standing between us. I can send you value, Nico. I can send you Bitcoin as easily as I can send you an email. And so the effect that this will have on global trade is immense and profound. So I really believe Bitcoin is world changing. And if we're going to have one currency, it should be Bitcoin.
I always tell people to tell me it's so easy to send Bitcoin, to send me a Bitcoin, but they never do.
Well, you don't want to send Bitcoin because you realize this is something which doesn't have any inflation built in. And one thing I find very interesting, I'm sure your audience has observed this in their friends and family and themselves. Once you realize there's a monetary good you can save in that can't be inflated, it switches your mindset to, you know, the mindset of spending to the mindset of savings. And this is a mindset, honestly, which hasn't existed for a century. Since before fiat currencies, the rise of fiat currencies in our social lives, before that there was gold, and people would understand this, you know, very easily, the desire to accumulate more gold because it can't be inflated away, and you have this sense of, oh, I've accumulated more savings that will increase over time. And it changes people's lifestyles. I know people who didn't save at all and they would live these kind of lavish lifestyles, living beyond their means, to becoming very strong savers and thinking, well, can I get a second job? Or what can I sell that I don't need? I don't need this car. It's like way too expensive. It costs me too much. I can get a more economical car and save more. And it changes people's mindsets. So I think that's really interesting, the kind of individual impact it has on us to want to be savers rather than living this kind of profligate lifestyle.
It's true. Seeing this is literally insane when you really look at it, especially in the German-speaking world. I mean, Germans have always been big savers. They don't like to spend too much money. They don't overconsume. You know, Europeans in general, we don't roll our credit cards. We just don't do that, right? We pay them off every month. We all do it. Nobody goes into debt. It's interesting to see that there's a Klarna, it's an app. I don't even know if you have it in the US, but it's like one of those apps where you can start paying for things in installments, right? And they're coming from Sweden, where they don't have any cash anymore. So we're also very cash based still, at least in Southern Europe. Mm-hmm. And I've met a guy, a Bitcoiner, who was on my show the other day, and he told me, he told me honestly, I only own one chair. He like literally only owns one chair and a little table that has his. And he says he does not invite people. He does not invite people home. But sometimes it happens, and then he just has to explain. But let's dwell into this. let's dwell into this a bit, because the mainstream argument would be, you know, if Bitcoin is a deflationary money, if we go into this deflationary world, we're all gonna die. You know, the world is gonna collapse. There's not gonna be any growth anymore. Everybody's just saving, and then nothing happens anymore. So what would be your counter?
Yeah, this is one of the big economic fallacies that came from Keynesian economics, was that unless you have inflation, people will have a desire to save, and so they don't spend. And the fallacy is that the growth of an economy comes from spending. That's a huge, huge fallacy. The growth of an economy comes from investing, and you only can invest if you accumulate savings. So savings is a fundamental part of the growth of an economy. And this is very easy to see if you think about it. You know, it's harder for people to think about it in a complex economy where lots of stuff is going on. But if you simplify and you think of an island economy where you are the only person and you have some savings, you have some fish, your savings are in fish because it's a very simple economy. Does the economy grow by you eating all the fish and consuming everything and spending what you have? No, it doesn't. It grows by setting aside some savings, some fish, so you can work on a net, a fishing net, so you can be more efficient. So you are using your savings and deferring immediate consumption to pay for an investment which will bring in more food or more income. And that's really, you know, the Austrian view of how economies grow. And I subscribe to the Austrian School of Economics, which is a long, venerable school of economics, which talks about the importance of hard money and the importance of savings and the accumulation of savings and capital formation. It's economies grow by capital formation, growing new factories, new businesses, new methods of producing things. They don't grow by people just sitting around eating or spending all the time. That is a later benefit that you get by investing, because you have, you're producing more so you can consume more. And so Keynesians have the cart before the horse, which is backwards. You need to accumulate more, you need to produce more, then you can consume more. You don't consume more to produce more.
I'm talking a lot about Germany, but I don't know if I haven't told you, but I am sitting in Vienna, Austria right now. I am from Austria, I'm not from Germany. So we don't have many Austrian economists left. I mean, there is some like Keynesians who would go on Twitter and say, and there's like, it's a trend really. It says economists from Austria, but definitely not an Austrian economist. They would have that in their Twitter bio, right? Just to tell people that they're...
In the United States, you would never need to say that, because the Austrian economists are so rare that, you know, for every Austrian economist, there's 10 Chicago school economists. And for every Chicago school economist, there's 10 Keynesians. So the academic world is absolutely deluged by Keynesian economists. So Austrian's actually very rare, but I think it's true economics. And, I think some of the greatest economists in history came from Austria. Hayek, Friedrich von Hayek and Ludwig von Mises, two incredibly brilliant economists. So I think Austrians should feel very proud to have produced this school of economics. And Karl Menger, I should also say.
I absolutely agree, but it will take some time. It will take a long time, because right now we are very, the establishment, especially in economics, is very left-wing, very Keynesian. You know, they hate everything that has to do with liberals, what we call liberals. Our liberals in German are your libertarians, right? And they just hate everything, you know. We're in the Austrian Parliament. We have a new, which it was renovated, right? And Hayek got a Hayek hallway. They threw a fit because Hayek is too dangerous, and we cannot talk about Hayek, even though he's the only Nobel Prize winner, you know, from Austria. Well, do you think that Bitcoin is resilient enough to basically win whatever happens?
No. I'm one of the people who is a very, very pro Bitcoin, but I think we're in this interesting gray area where it's not clear whether Bitcoin is so deeply established that it can't be killed. I think that question will be answered in the next 5 years, and it's really a question of, does Bitcoin get enough political capture? Does it have enough of the population owning it that it becomes essentially impossible for politicians to kill it? Because it's very hard for politicians to kill something that their constituents own a lot of, because it will really harm them directly. I think Bitcoin is owned by probably somewhere between 3 and 10% of the world's population, probably on the lower side. I think it really needs to get an ownership base of close to 20% to 30% before it becomes very, very difficult. And also you want actually the politicians themselves to be owners too. And you're seeing signs of this, at least from where I sit in the United States. There's United States senators that own Bitcoin. There are congressmen that own Bitcoin. And those are people who are not going to create legislation which destroys something that they believe in enough that they own it. We just need that to grow. And the example I give of this is the ride-sharing company Uber. I don't know if you know the history of Uber, but one of the things that they did was they would go into these cities and launch their product without permission. And local governments often were very antagonistic towards Uber because they had this strong internal lobby, which was the taxi lobby, saying you need to shut this down, this business is really bad for us. But Uber would go into a city without permission and it would get a bunch of users and drivers very, very quickly because it was a great product. And then once the local city government started acting and trying to legislate against Uber, there were enough people who would push back and say, no, you can't get rid of Uber, I get my salary from Uber, or I'm a customer of Uber and I use it every day. And so it became very difficult for governments to shut Uber down. And I think the process that Bitcoin is going through is a similar process of political capture. And that process, I think, is really going to play out over the next 5 years. Because that the next 5 years, I think governments are going to finally awaken to the threat of Bitcoin. If Bitcoin is owned by, say, 30% of the global population, or even 30% of the population of Western countries, I think nation states are going to start worrying about the effect on monetary policy.
So Uber, for me, is a problematic example, because they actually did manage to kill Uber here in Vienna. So that didn't work out. I mean, we still have it, but you pay the same. It's basically just you can just call a taxi with Uber, right? But besides that, if two questions may be rolled into one, okay? First question would be, where do we really stand with the US? Because we've seen the SEC go against crypto, you know, go against the rest of the blockchain, Web3, whatever industry. But so far, Bitcoin has been basically unharmed. It may even have been strengthened. And the second question would be, because it's a global phenomenon, right? I talk to people from Nigeria, I talk to people from Lebanon, I talk to people from Europe. It's a global phenomenon. So if you ban it in one country, there is a possibility that it's going to be a problem for you down the line if another country does not ban it. Am I correct here, or does it all hang in the balance with what the US does because it has so much power?
I think it does hang in the balance with the US, because the US, that there is so much of the global savings is concentrated in the US, and really the process of monetization is just savings moving from other assets, other dollar-denominated assets, into Bitcoin. So the US government, if it wanted to, could really do a lot of damage to the process of monetization, even if other countries weren't going to ban it. And also, the US tends to be kind of this financial bully with other countries. It kind of pulls other countries along with it, because it does this by saying, if you want access to our markets, then you need to comply with US regulations in certain ways. And even, you know, the famous example of Switzerland, where people could go and send their savings and be completely immune from any other country, the US actually applied a lot of pressure to Switzerland and got them to comply with a lot of US regulations. So I think if the US were to become very antagonistic towards Bitcoin, it could do a lot of damage to the process of monetization. But you're correct. The US has been generally very friendly towards Bitcoin, which is ironic, because the country which has the most to lose in its global position if Bitcoin becomes a reserve currency is the United States. The United States has the reserve currency of the world currently, the US dollar. If that was displaced, it would certainly reduce the ability of the United States to project its power around the world. Having the reserve currency gives you a lot of power, because you have the most important financial network and you can cut people off and really harm them. So, for instance, Iran is a country that's completely cut off from the US dollar network, and that really harms them a lot. So if Bitcoin were to become the global reserve currency, then nation states could interact with each other without any hindrance at all, without any other political power interfering. And this is I end my book actually with a quote from Charles de Gaulle, who says, we need to get back to a currency of a monetary base for the world, which doesn't bear the mark of any political institution. And that includes the United States. It's better for the world if we're all on a level playing field and we're using a currency that can't be controlled by any nation state.
Bei Coinfinity, da heißt es seit 2014 Bringing Bitcoin to the People. Diese Firma hat Bitcoin wirklich in der DNA, und das merkt man an allen Stellen. Beim wirklich sehr guten Service, bei der persönlichen Betreuung im Grazer Front Office und bei den Services, die reichen von High Net Worth, Individual Betreuung bis zur Beratung, wenn es um die sichere Verwahrung von Bitcoin geht. Und auch jede andere Frage kann man dem Team von Coinfinity stellen und bekommt garantiert eine gute Antwort. Coinfinity ist der Hauptsponsor dieses Podcasts, und das Team, das startet jetzt gerade richtig durch. Es gibt ein neues Webportal. Dort kann man kaufen, verkaufen und einen Sparplan anlegen, was sicher die entspannteste Art ist, Bitcoiner zu sein. Und neue Features kommen auch ständig dazu. Das Portal ist aus aller Welt erreichbar. Seht es euch an unter coinfinity.co. Self-Custody, also die Selbstaufbewahrung von Bitcoin, ist ein ganz zentraler Punkt bei Bitcoin, bei der Idee hinter Bitcoin und bei der Technologie. Ich habe selbst die volle Verfügung über meine Coins, über mein Vermögen. Und das geht am besten mit einer Hardware-Wallet.
Eine Hardware-Wallet, das ist wie ein USB-Stick, den ich in den Computer stecke. Und die allerbeste ist die Bitbox O2 von Shift Crypto. Mit USB-C, geht wunderbar auch am Laptop, kann man auch am Handy verwenden, am Android-Handy. Hergestellt in der Schweiz, entwickelt in der Schweiz, hoher Sicherheitsgrad, eine clean und slicke Software, auch alles auf Deutsch, der Support auf Deutsch. Man kann auch ein eigenes Einstiegsgespräch buchen, wo die ganze Einrichtung perfekt erklärt wird. Reinschauen bei shiftcrypto.ch und mit dem Code, was Bitcoin bringt, gibt es 5% Rabatt.
Ich habe jetzt seit über einem Jahr das Privileg, in der Bitcoin-Community fast Vollzeit tätig zu sein und da lerne ich natürlich viele tolle Leute kennen und die haben für die Community von Was Bitcoin bringt einiges parat. Zum Beispiel satoshistore.io, da gibt es die Was Bitcoin bringt Collection, die Nico Collection, auch die Fixed Money Collection von meinem englischen Kanal und mit Was Bitcoin bringt als Code bekommt ihr auf das gesamte Sortiment dieses wirklich coolen Shops, der unglaublich viel zu bieten hat, bekommt ihr 5%. Was Bitcoin bringt, satoshistore.io. Aber damit nicht genug. Mit Was Bitcoin bringt, dem Code, gibt es auch 5% auf die Hardware-Wallet von Shift Crypto, die Bitbox O2, meiner Meinung nach die beste und coolste Hardware-Wallet. Und wer wirklich auf Nummer sicher gehen will, der schaut bei Seedor.io vorbei. Seedor.io, da wird dann gemeißelt, gehämmert und geschlagen und der Seed wird für immer aufbewahrt auf Stahl. Seedor.io mit Was Bitcoin bringt, dem Code, gibt es auch dort 5%.
I would agree. And De Gaulle was always very skeptical of the Americans or anybody. He was skeptical of anybody, really. I've seen this I shouldn't be talking about this so much because it's very recent. But there's I've this article here. It's called The Birth of the Bitcoin Dollar. Have you ever heard of it?
No.
It was written by Mark Goodwin, who is with the Bitcoin magazine, and it was actually written in September, and he was just on Preston Pish's podcast. And he made an interesting argument in this article. He said that from the perspective of the US, who now have the petrodollar, right, where you have to use the dollar to get into the most important commodity, you could have something like a Bitcoin dollar where you are forced to use the US dollar basically in the form of a real US dollar or a US dollar stablecoin, but you have to use the US dollar to get into the most important savings commodity, the most important monetary commodity, and that would be Bitcoin. So his argument is basically that the US is going to capture Bitcoin, but by accepting it, not trying to manipulate it out of existence. And I'm going to combine this with my own personal, very optimistic view of the possibilities of the US. It's like, if any country has the possibility to go on a hard money capitalist standard, it would be the US, right? And it would give them the chance to basically have another 100 years of domination, because no, China, Russia are not going to be able to deal with a Bitcoin standard-based system. They're just not equipped to do that.
Yeah, so certainly, culturally, it would be much harder for China to work on a Bitcoin standard because it would give their population so much more freedom and to transact without so much surveillance. And it's a nation whose government really wants to surveil everything that their population does. So I agree with you there. And it's certainly, what you're saying is certainly possible. The US dollar historically was backed by gold. and it's certainly possible that the US dollar could be backed by Bitcoin as well. So that is one eventuality where you could have Bitcoin becoming the reserve currency in the sense that it is the mechanism of savings for both individuals and nation states. And the transactional layer will be done in the fiat currency, say dollars. So you go to the grocery store and you buy stuff with dollars, but ultimately the value of the dollar is backed by something valuable, which is Bitcoin. That is certainly a possibility. And nation states will, if Bitcoin does become monetized, they'll certainly try and keep some level of power in their nation's monetary good, because that's where a lot of their sovereign power comes from, is control over the money. But it's important. One thing I like to tell people is that money has different functions, and people usually focus on the medium of exchange function of money. They think about money as the thing that you buy stuff with, you go to the grocery store with, and they ignore the savings aspect, which is, I think, by far the most important aspect of money, is where are savings held? And I'll give you an example of this. in Argentina, people started saving in dollars because their currency was hyperinflating. Or you could go back to the example of Weimar Germany, where people would they would transact in the Deutschmark, but they would save in gold. Wherever they could find gold, they would keep their savings in gold. And what that means is it strips governments of the power of inflation to pay for themselves. Because if people are keeping their savings in another currency, the government, when it inflates, is not able to extract as much savings. So in Argentina, when people save in dollars, the government can't spend as much because the value of their currency is, you know, fallen so quickly from inflation. So my point is, it's possible that you could have a currency set up, just as you said, where people transact in dollars, but they save in Bitcoin. That would strip so much power from the United States government. It would entirely strip away their ability to inflate, because the pool of savings would be in Bitcoin, not in dollars.
What about stocks and real estate and art and gold itself? What about all the other things that we are using to save money today?
I think stocks certainly will not be affected to a large extent because we still need businesses to produce things. And it doesn't really matter what currency a stock is denominated in. A stock could be denominated in gold or Bitcoin or dollars. That doesn't matter. It will affect markets where people use them as savings vehicles primarily. Stocks are not really savings vehicles per se, they're production vehicles. You invest in a company because you think it's going to produce more. Whereas real estate and fine art, they are savings vehicles because you put money into them just for the belief that other people will want to put money into them in the future. So you believe that other people will want to save in them. And an example of this is the real estate market in Vancouver, which is in Canada. There are a lot of houses which just sit completely empty because people in China want some of their savings outside of the mainland so they can be safe. If they escape, they'll have some savings out there. And they're using real estate not as something they produce something with, but as a way of saving, keeping some of my saving outside of the country. So asset classes which are being used as savings vehicles will see some of those savings flow into Bitcoin because Bitcoin is so much superior to these other vehicles, certainly superior to real estate, because you can't transmit real estate, right? If you've saved your money in a house in Vancouver in Canada and you're someone who is Chinese and suddenly you want to transfer some of your savings to a child or to an aunt or an uncle who live in Austria, How do you do that? You have to go and you have to find a real estate agent. You have to sell it. There's a process. You have to get the money into the bank. You have to transfer it. You have to ask the bank's permission. So many steps. So if you are someone who's keeping savings, having something that's liquid that can be transmitted is so far superior. So slowly over time, people who are saving in these other competing savings vehicles will see that Bitcoin is superior and it will drain savings out. And probably the one that will stand to lose the most from this are government bonds and gold. Those are the two competing savings vehicles which will be most harmed by the rise of Bitcoin.
I mean, I agree on the bonds. I'm not sure about the gold, but we don't have to get into that too much. But I would say that if I own an ETF or an index fund or even a mutual fund, it is saving, right? I have 2,000 stocks in my ETF. I have no idea what companies I'm investing in. I'm not investing in them because I think they're going to do great. I'm investing in them because I'll just grow with the market. That's the whole idea that was started actually shortly after the end of the gold standard in the 70s. So it is savings.
But why I would ask the question, why do they grow with the market? They grow with the market because the underlying companies in these mutual funds are producing something. They're producing something of value, so they're valued in a different way. They're ultimately valued based on the cash flow that they produce, because they are growing a business or they're building something that people desire, like, you know, the phone in your pocket. They're producing more of them, so they have more cash flow, and so those things are going to be valuable regardless. And you can denominate their value in dollars or yen or. So Apple has a certain amount of value, regardless of whether you price it in dollars or yen or gold. That value is because it's producing something that people want and they'll pay for. And that's going to be true under a Bitcoin standard as well.
You write in your book that once the first countries go on the Bitcoin standard or buy Bitcoin for their reserves, there will be a stampede. This is an idea that I've heard a lot, but we have seen one country, El Salvador, doing that, and no other country so far. So do you think that, were you wrong on this? Is this something that's just still coming? Are countries just buying it like secretly? I mean, this is possible. Where's the stampede? I mean, because if Bitcoin is so great, I totally agree. I think I've been a gold bug for a long time. It took me a while to get that Bitcoin is better in the end, and I want Bitcoin to succeed very much because I think, like you said, you know, people turn into savers. People are actually more honest with each other and find new. It's amazing to see how many Bitcoiners are opening a business and starting, you know, basically a whole new life because they have something they can build on, right? But on the other hand, if Bitcoin is as great as we think it is, why is there not more people, you know, stampeding into it right now, or countries or companies, right? We have Tesla and MicroStrategy, but it's just a handful.
Yeah, I think El Salvador was an interesting case because I think it was almost an anomaly in the sense that I did not expect nation states to enter the Bitcoin market this prior cycle, the one that ended in, you know, 2021. I thought it would happen two or three cycles from now. I thought it would happen a decade from now, you know, in some time. And then I thought there would be a stampede of nation states. El Salvador is a very interesting case of a small nation with a president who has a lot of political power, who's able to push through something which would be very difficult in other countries, where if you don't have that executive power invested in one person who suddenly says, oh, you know, I really think Bitcoin is great, you have to win over the entire political establishment. So I think that you could, I agree with you, the prediction is wrong in the sense that there wasn't a stampede, but I also think El Salvador is a strange exception to a nation state that entered the market much earlier than I would have expected it to. I do think it will plant the seeds for other nation states to become interested in Bitcoin, because they will look at the example of El Salvador and say, this nation is lifting itself out of poverty. It's attracting international attention. People are, you know, flocking to El Salvador in droves. People who have a lot of technical skills as well, engineers and people who are educated, and moving to El Salvador because they want to live a life where Bitcoin is a big part of their life, and El Salvador is welcoming them in. So I think nation states in South America and Central America in particular will look at the example of El Salvador 5 or 10 years from now and say, wow, this is a nation which did enrich itself by choosing this policy. Maybe we should consider this policy as well, and legalizing Bitcoin as legal tender in our country. That, I think, is probably when you'll see the stampede. I still think it will happen. I just didn't expect something like El Salvador to happen in the prior cycle.
You talked about Argentina, and I lived in Argentina for a year. It's where I learned a lot about inflation that is now coming to Europe. And Argentina is the poster child for inflation, right? It would be the perfect country for Bitcoin, with the exception that most people already have access to dollars, so maybe that's the difference. But did you know that they had to sign a little piece of paper when they got the last IMF loan that they're not going to go into Bitcoin, that they're not going to do it?
I did not know that, and that's an interesting example of a political institution applying pressure to prevent something that they don't like.
It tells me that they are thinking about this at the IMF level. They just published another thing where they basically told their member countries not to do a legal tender thing. But it was interesting because the president of Argentina, a couple months before that, he would talk about Bitcoin, right? He would say, man, I'm thinking about it. And the central bank immediately said, stop thinking about it. And in the end, I think it was a bargaining tactic, right? It was just a tactic to get some leverage with the IMF. He was never thinking about actually introducing Bitcoin, but he used Bitcoin, the meme, to scare the IMF into giving him more money. That's my personal opinion.
Well, that sounds like it was quite effective. It may be that nation states, their hand is forced into Bitcoin because it happens as a bottom-up phenomenon where if you have, you know, 30 or 40% of your population deciding by themselves that they want to keep savings in Bitcoin, which is certainly possible in a country like Argentina, which has had a long history of inflation, they may be forced by recognizing, hey, all of our citizens have Bitcoin. Why don't we just switch over to making it legal tender and going onto a Bitcoin standard? And by then, it might be impossible for the IMF to do anything.
I mean, that absolutely. If that's what you talked about before, right? If there enough people own it, if enough people think about it, I mean, there are Bitcoiners are obsessed with Bitcoin, and we're gonna be one issue voters for the rest of our lives probably. So politically, there is a big chance there. And this is also how I want to end this. When El Salvador introduced Bitcoin, Austria is a small country, right? So here in Vienna, you know, not everybody knows everybody, but I've been a journalist for 20 years, so I know a couple of people in politics and in the government, and I would write them text messages and saying, look at what El Salvador has done. We have to start buying Bitcoin. We can do it secretly, but we have to start. But they don't care. they don't care. But so my question would be this: in the US, in DC, we know that there is a big crypto lobby. Are Bitcoiners basically doing enough to talk to politicians, explain things to them? Because we can't expect them to understand everything. You know, we can't expect them to read up on Mises and Hayek within a couple of months and weeks. So is there enough being done, you think?
Well, let me just start by saying I agree with your premise. I think we should be doing more. I think there are some Bitcoiners who will say this is inevitable. Bitcoin is going to take over the global financial system on its own. It doesn't need any help. But I disagree with that. I think it is important to be lobbying governments. There are people who are working on this. I would like there to be more people who are working on just the Bitcoin side. Unfortunately, often the people who are incentivized to go lobby are the ones, companies who are working in these, you know, altcoin casinos who want permission to let you know, their users gamble with these cryptocurrencies, which are not going to exist in a few years. So unfortunately, I think if anything, that is bad for Bitcoin by association. We don't want to be associated with all this gambling. This is, for me, it's about changing the world for the better, producing a new monetary good where you can keep your savings and transmit your savings without worry of confiscation or inflation. That's very, very important. These altcoins are all just about gambling and just nonsense, and often just created to enrich a small group of people who created them and are trying to get some of the credibility of Bitcoin to shine on them so they can enrich themselves. So I'm very skeptical of that kind of lobbying. But interestingly, in the US, you've mentioned this a little bit in our chat, that the US government actually seems much more friendly towards Bitcoin than it does to all these cryptocurrency projects. The SEC and Gary Gensler have said, we're going to treat these as securities. Which is essentially saying you're treating these other cryptocurrencies like a stock in a company, and we're going to regulate them that way. Bitcoin, they're saying, is different. It is a currency. It's not controlled by anyone. And so because of that, we're going to treat it in a different, favorable way. So there's the downside of the fact that I don't think there's enough lobbying for Bitcoin alone, but then there's the upside that it seems like they recognize, that regulators recognize, that these altcoins are essentially vehicles for gambling to enrich small groups of people, and they're treating it that way. And I think there's, that's beneficial in the sense that they've recognized that.
I mean, listening to Gary Gensler is almost frightening. I mean, the things he says are most like 99% correct, in my opinion, when it comes to Bitcoin and crypto. And I mean, when you read between the lines, not even between the lines, when he talks about Bitcoin, he sounds a bit like a very, very polite version of Michael Saylor. And I'm not saying Michael Saylor is not polite. I'm just saying very, very, you know, he tries to cover his political behind, right? But he understands this clearly, and he seems to be the only one on a very high-level government position who does.
Yeah, I think in regard to altcoins, certainly I think he does understand that there's a very important distinction between Bitcoin and these other ones. On the other hand, I think he is preventing the development of Bitcoin, the financialization of Bitcoin, because he's making it hard for companies to produce products around Bitcoin. So, for instance, futures markets, options trading. I think that's all an important part of the monetization of Bitcoin. And it's very difficult to get a license to do that. And so the United States is actually behind Europe in this. So most of the options trading around Bitcoin happens in Europe. It doesn't happen in the United States. And so I think the SEC has done harm to Bitcoin in that sense. And you can say it's helped consumers in another sense, that it's pointing out to them, hey, these other things that are lumping themselves in with Bitcoin are actually very different. They are securities. They're not a currency. So it's done both good and bad. And net, I would say I would probably prefer the SEC wasn't there and it was like a true free market. But there is some benefit that they've produced, I think.
Well, Vijay, let me ask you at the end, because we are talking about the German translation of your book. Do you know how many German speakers there are in the world?
Oh goodness, that's interesting. I would guess it would be hundreds of millions, but maybe not a billion. Is that correct?
Unfortunately, it's a lot less. It's about 130 million.
Ah, okay.
But they do read a lot, and they have a lot of money to buy Bitcoin with. So that's important to know. I just want to end this with asking you if you had like a message or something you want to say to your future German readers, and also I want to tell you a little bit about. I mean, I want to tell you that there is a huge German Bitcoin scene. It's been exploding for 3 years now. There's like, I could basically spend every weekend going to a Bitcoin conference somewhere in the German speaking world. It is, I mean, my wife will kill me, so I won't, but I could. And it's completely insane what we've seen here. The interest is enormous. That's why, I mean, even if when you look on YouTube and podcasts and whatever. So I don't know. Do you have some specific message?
Yeah, I know that Germany has been a country which has been very interested in Bitcoin for a long time, because I've been interested in Bitcoin for a long time. I got into Bitcoin in 2011, and I always knew that there was a strong group of people in Germany who were very, very pro Bitcoin. I would read articles about it. I thought that was super exciting, because Bitcoin is a global phenomena. And I think that's so cool that there's such a strong scene in Germany. My one message that I would give to people is that, you know, Bitcoin goes through these cycles, and the best time to be interested in Bitcoin, to learn about Bitcoin, or to build in the Bitcoin space is during the bear market. And we're in a bear market now. The people who get interested in Bitcoin during the bear market are always the people who do the best. I've always found that I've tried to get people interested in Bitcoin during bear markets. It's very hard. During the bull market, it's really easy. I have people, friends and family, sending me messages without me even talking to them, saying, tell me about Bitcoin. I want to learn about Bitcoin. And I always think, oh, it's happening again. They, you know, this is getting near the end of the cycle. They're going to put some savings in Bitcoin right at the top, and then it's going to crash, and then they're going to say, oh, that was silly. The people who get it, But the good thing about those people is they come back the next cycle. So it's not all lost. It's just they go through pain. I would say to your listeners, now is the very best time to learn as much as you can about Bitcoin, why it's important, why you should keep your savings in Bitcoin, or why you should build a business on Bitcoin, or, you know, why you should, you know, speak to the people around you, friends and family, about why keeping some of their savings in Bitcoin is good for them, good for their future, and gives them more freedom. I mean, it's a very, very powerful thing. If you've ever felt the ability to cross a border with some of your savings that no one can stop you from taking, it's a very powerful thing. And I always think of the example of the great Austrian economist Ludwig von Mises, one of my heroes, who fled across Europe, escaping the Nazis. And he came to America, but he came to America without any savings. He wasn't able to keep any savings. This was during the lead up to World War II. And I think, and he had to accept a very, you know, not prestigious job. It was not a prestigious job, and he didn't have anything. If he had had Bitcoin, he could have moved his whole life over to the US and lived a more fulfilling life, and not had to accept a job just because he didn't have any savings. We have that power now. We have that power with Bitcoin, and it's so important and so powerful. And I think it's really great to be able to explain that to people and the freedom that it brings them. So I hope my book can do that for German readers once the translation is published. They can see its importance, its economic importance, and its importance to the world.
Well, Vijay, thank you so much for taking the time. This was great talking to you. Have you ever been to Vienna where Mises and Hayek did
work? I have not. I have been to Bavaria, but I have not been to Austria. I would love to visit Vienna. It's one of the places that I'm most excited to visit. It's on my top three places on earth that I'd love to visit.
Well, I hope you make it. I hope we can bring you here somehow, and I hope you say hi so we can do this chat, the second chat in person. That would be my honor. Thank you for taking your time.
Danke fürs Zuhören bei dieser Folge von Was Bitcoin bringt. Wenn es euch gefallen hat, bitte hinterlasst uns 5 Sterne bei Apple und bei Spotify, folgt uns auf YouTube, schickt uns eure Eindrücke, eure Ideen, eure Anregungen, eure Vorschläge für Gäste und natürlich auch eure Kritik an hallo@wasbitcoinbringt.com. Was nicht unerwähnt bleiben darf, natürlich auch Value for Value. Dieser Podcast läuft über das Lightning-Netzwerk in allen Kanälen. Man kann streamen, man kann spenden. Es gibt einen Spenden-Button auch auf wasbitcoinbringt.com inzwischen. Und diese Dinge sind auch wahnsinnig motivierend, wenn da ein bisschen was reinkommt, wenn jeder das nutzt. Es macht wirklich viel Freude, als Bitcoiner für Bitcoiner zu arbeiten.
Die Veröffentlichungen in diesem Podcast sowie die darin enthaltenen Hinweise, die im Begleitmaterial gesetzten Links, dienen ausschließlich Informationszwecken und stellen weder eine Anlageberatung, Anlageanalyse noch eine Aufforderung oder Empfehlung zum Erwerb oder Verkauf von Finanzinstrumenten dar. Insbesondere kann eine Anlage oder sonstige Beratung dadurch nicht ersetzt werden. Die in den Veröffentlichungen erhaltenen Angaben basieren auf dem Wissensstand zum Zeitpunkt der Ausarbeitung und können jederzeit ohne weitere Benachrichtigungen geändert werden. Die Inhalte richten sich ausschließlich an natürliche Personen. Es wird keine Haftung für die Richtigkeit, Vollständigkeit oder Aktualität der zur Verfügung gestellten Informationen, Informationsquellen, daraus resultierenden Haftungen oder Schäden jedweder Art übernommen. Eine Haftung für leicht fahrlässiges Verhalten wird jedenfalls ausgeschlossen.